Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Vonna Pfeiffer.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artist. Mm-hmm. Mike Parr is our artist this week. Mike Parr Embroidery. Yes, same name, same spelling. Now, that's, for me, not very common at all. So, you're in Canada.
Yes, I live in Ottawa, actually.
Yes. And it's interesting because my family, the origins of my family are England, and then yours too. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. My parents came over from Liverpool during the 50s.
Okay.
But the Parr name actually does originate from Northern England traditionally. Of course, the most famous person being Catherine Parr, you know, the last wife of Henry VIII.
Right.
She's no real relative, though, because she didn't have any children, as far as I know. So.
Now, see, that's okay. So that's interesting. So sorry, folks, if you wanted to hear about needlework, too bad. Because my aunt, who was the all-time genealogy tracker before the internet, my family got to the States because the British were bringing orphan boys over to fight in the Revolutionary War. And they brought a couple of brothers over named Parr. And so, and then they settled in Southern Illinois. And so that's where my family, my grandparents were from Southern Illinois. And so that's how we got to the States. And my aunt said that she actually traced us back to Catherine Parr's family in some way or another. So we are connected at that point somewhere.
Yeah, we're all sort of interconnected that way, but it's not like we're her descendants or anything like that. But one of the things about the name Parr is that it's a really important name in the history of embroidery. And I'm not referring to me or you.
Certainly not me.
No, maybe, not me.
Yeah, just putting that out there right now. No, what I'm referring to, actually, you've probably never heard of this gentleman. His name was John Parr, and he lived from 1532 to 1607. And he's one of the two official court-appointed embroiderers to Elizabeth I and then King James I just after her. And he died with having two daughters, you know, so the family name didn't carry on. But he is, you know, distantly related to us, like all the Parrs are in some way. And we know about him because he was really, really important in the Broderers Guild at the time, who did all the embroideries for the royal court. And we actually have household accounts which show that he was paid, you know, X many pounds to do three dresses for Queen Elizabeth and you know, various other things. So his name pops up throughout the accounts from the royal wardrobe at that time.
See, and that's interesting because my brother's name is John, so that's too weird.
Yes, and it happens to be my first name too. I was named after my dad, so it was never used. It would be too confusing, but yeah. So when I got into the whole embroidery recreation scene, I was quite surprised to discover my name, you know, going that far back. And it was a bit serendipitous, I guess.
Yeah. So this John Parr, then, he was, back in the day when men did a lot of that work, then he was actually designing and creating. And then this Broderers Guild, is that where we get embroidery? Is that?
Yes. Yes, it was one of the livery guilds, and it was the livery guilds are they're the things like the farriers and the metal workers and the leather workers, and they would provide all the items that were used at the royal court. That was their job, and they were sort of like a trades guild, you know. So they were the masters and the apprentices and the journeymen. And this will come as no surprise to you, Vonna, but they were all men. Because, of course, women weren't allowed to own property and they weren't allowed to be professional anything. So even though women worked on these things, They were given sort of the lower down tasks, like, you know, maybe mounting a piece onto a frame and doing the lacing or cutting up some of the threads and things like that. And it was the men who were the professionals and who did the work, because they were the only ones who could be trusted with the very expensive materials. I know, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But that's the way they looked at it back then. And, you know, they used to actually, when they worked with gold, they used to weigh the gold, and they would weigh it in, and then they would weigh all the clippings at the end, because they had to be accountable for everything that they used, because if it was thought that they were hoarding things, they, you know, and trying to sell it or use it to make money off of, they would go to prison.
Oh,
yeah, it was very strict. It was a very, very strict time. And going back to the Broderers Guild, they were founded in the late 1400s, early 1500s, I think. It's out there on the website if anyone's interested in looking at it. And they still exist today. But today they are kind of a, they don't have anything to do specifically with embroidery anymore, at least not actually doing it. They're more like a charitable organization, similar to the Shriners, I guess. You have to be very wealthy to belong to it, and they get together and they hold fundraisers, and they support things like the Royal School of Needlework is one of their charities, but also I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this, but it's a charity called Fine Cell Work. And in Britain, this charity goes into prisons and they teach inmates how to do embroidery. And then they actually do embroidery, which they sell for income while they're in prison.
Huh. And it's fine. Say that again. Fine Cell Work?
No, Fine Cell Work, like a jail cell.
Oh, okay. Huh.
They have an interesting website if you want to go and check them out. But they're one of the main charities that the Broderers support. They're called the Worshipful Company of Broderers. And so they've been around since the, I think, 1450s or something along those lines.
See, this is really interesting to me, because one of my first trips to Europe was a press trip for I edit magazines, trade magazines. And the first time I went, and of course I'm all jet lagged and half out of whack, and we have this press dinner, and it's in this beautiful facility, old beautiful facility that they said was it was a guild, it was like the meeting house of the guild, of one of
the guild halls.
Yeah, guild hall. And I tried to ask, but it was like, you know, it was explained as if I already knew what a guild was, and so I kind of got the gist of it. I didn't realize how significant these guilds were, but apparently major players.
Yeah. Then. Well, they were almost like a closed society, really, because they were so in order to be, you know, anything like a cobbler or a tailor or what have you, you had to go through an apprenticeship, and, you know, which was, I don't know, 7-8 years. And then you became a journeyman, which meant you were like a sort of a graduate, but not quite a master yet. And then eventually you became a master, and then you would have apprentices underneath you. And so nobody else could actually put up a sign and say that they were a tailor unless they'd gone through this process. And if they did, they would be sent to prison. So it was sort of a, almost like a quality control thing, but they also lived and worked together. So they became like, you know, micro societies within society. And so they only socialized together, and they worshiped together, and they ate together and drank together, you know, so they became like these big extended families who all did their work following their standards.
Yet each of them had their own families and lives outside the guild. Yeah,
they did, but they all kind of stayed together. You know, society at that time was very, you know, stratified, right? So you didn't go beyond your class. And so belonging to the guilds was a certain portion of the middle class, and you didn't go below it, and you didn't try to go above it either. So,
Yeah, and it was the same. Heaven forbid you'd advance yourself.
Yeah, exactly, because then you'd be getting above your station. And this wasn't just in England. It was all throughout Europe. I mean, one of the most beautiful guild halls still in existence is the one in Nuremberg, Germany, and which is where a lot of the whole concept of guilds came out of the German-speaking countries. So.
Well, now there's some history I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So certainly the fact that you're involved in needlework of any kind has nothing to do with the Brooders Guild.
Oh, heavens, no.
Yeah, okay.
No, you have to be quite wealthy to belong to them. And I don't think that the Brooders Guild has had a member who could actually do embroidery since sometime in the 1700s. and they're not alone. I mean, many of those other livery guilds in England, they, you know, the things that they did don't even exist anymore, really. So they're really just organizations set up for charity work. But how I became aware of the Broderers Guild was through my work with Cynthia Jackson, who is a dear friend of mine and a wonderful designer and teacher in her own right. And she was doing research into the guild crowns. So all of these guilds, they had a warden. The warden was the man who ran the administration of the guild, as well as being like the senior master of the guild. And they would have these crowning ceremonies. And all of the crowns that, and most of them still exist, they're, you know, kept in museums or in private collections. All of these crowns have some form of embroidery on them in some way. Even if it's like the leather worker's crown, they have embroidery on them. And she was studying the embroidery on these crowns when she became aware of the crowns that belong to the Broderers Guild. And they were sort of hidden away. Most of the guild itself had no idea about them. Only the current warden knew anything about them. And there are two of them, and one of them was, the first one was made approximately in 1580, and the second one was made around 1610-ish, and both of them are in relatively poor shape after, you know, 400 and some years, and they've been not seen. They had not been photographed. I think the second one appeared in a book in 1911, and that was the only photograph ever taken of either one of them. And probably that one was chosen because it's a little more aesthetically appealing, and it's also in better shape than the original one. But she spent a long time trying to get access to those two crowns to study them. And finally, they granted her the access. And after she saw them and realized what was on these two particular crowns, she applied for a grant, and she received a grant from the Historic Costume Society, I believe that's what they're called in England, to actually recreate one of the crowns. And so she chose the first crown because it was the most damaged of the two. But the other reason was it had, many dozens of techniques on it that have never, ever been repeated again, as far as we can tell. They're not on any other existing piece of embroidery. And so what you have to imagine when you look at this crown is that, all the different masters in the guild were working on this, and their apprentices as well. And they were creating these elements out of silk and gold, and kind of trying to, I think they were trying to outdo one another. There might be, I think there's like four or five.
Man.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah. The competition, right?
Yeah.
And so there's about, let's say there's four or five white lily flowers on this crown. And each one is stitched in a completely different way, and yet they're stitched with the same threads. So they have a theme running across them. But when you study them closely, they're all using completely different techniques. And
Mike, let me stop you here. So let me understand. So Cynthia's, when she got the funding, then is to recreate this crown or to restore it?
No, it could not be restored. It was to create a modern version of it using supplies that would get us as close as we could to the original, which was a challenge. Because a lot of what went into that crown hasn't been created in hundreds of years and is not available. And once she got the grant, it started a 2-year process for her. And it's really unusual when you think about it, because normally this sort of stuff is done in England, but she's in Canada, like me, and so she would travel back and forth to London to do her research, and with access to the crown and doing very precise measurements of everything. And the damage on the crown made it possible to really see quite a bit of the construction of all these little elements, and because the techniques were in many cases very surprising to us today. They would have, like for a leaf, you might stitch the leaf in one kind of green silk or two kinds of green silk, and then you would completely cover that up with gold, and then you would actually stitch all over that with silk again, and then you might even add more gold on top of that in a different method. And so you would have these layers upon layers upon layers, which were... again, so unique and so difficult to recreate. And it was a really long process trying to do this. And how I became involved was, first she had to create what we refer to as the prototype crown. And then that went back to London, and it got compared to the original crown kind of on a lazy Susan with one on top of the other, and being able to see each element so we could see, did the color of the silk need to change? Did the size need to be adjusted in any way? And then the whole crown then got recreated one more time. And that was when I got involved. I spent about 4 months during the winter of 2018, working on sections of the crown myself. And the reason for that was because so many people had been involved in the first crown that we needed more than one stitcher to work on the second one. I should say the original crown. And then, because even if you're doing the same thing, you've probably noticed that you stitching the same design as me, they'll look totally different when you put them side by side.
Right.
Yeah. So we needed at least one other person to get involved. So I had been watching Cynthia, working on this all throughout the year that she was putting the prototype together. And we talked and said, you know, I would really like to be involved in this in some way too. And so I learned some of the techniques as we were going on, and I even managed to take a couple of those techniques that I was learning and put them into designs of my own that I have created, and then I actually got the go ahead to work on the actual crown itself. So it was a really fascinating process for me, because I saw the whole research side of it as well as the creation side of it. And you know, when you look at the photographs of the recreated crown, you have to picture, Cynthia and I creating our own gold in some cases. The gold work manufacturers in England, Benton and Johnson, they were really, really good to us. They tried as best as they could to provide us with tools and supplies that we could use. But, you know, some of the gold pearls and the winding strapping that creates the vines on the crown, you know, you have to picture us, you know, in her husband's tool shop, you know, with drills and guitar strings and winding, you know, fine gold wire around guitar strings at a high speed in order to be able to get enough of this in an even method so that it would show up, you know, as close as the original, as close as it could to the original. And I mean, some other things we had to do were, you know, we had to create pearls by taking the finest gold wire you can find and wrapping it around our own needles to create little pearls to sew onto the crown, because they're just not made in that fineness anymore.
Wow. What an honor to get involved in that, though.
Oh, it really was. It really was. It was an honor. It was also, I think, a good deal of luck.
Hey.
But the project did change my life, I have to admit. And when you look at these pieces, when you look at the elements on this crown, the flowers and the fruit and the leaves, there were things on there that were so difficult to do. I think one lily flower took me 7 or 8 days to create, and I was working at it 8 hours a day.
Oh,
wow.
See, Ivana, and you get all worked up over a Montenegrin stitch. See, it's nothing. It's nothing.
Not.
So Mike, yeah. This and every element in this crown then, because men were trying to one up each other, then you had to study every one as its own individual element, regardless of whether it was just another white flower.
That's right. Each one was so very different to the other. And that was when I talked about how Cynthia chose to do the first crown rather than the second crown. The second crown is incredibly beautiful, but they went a little easier on themselves, I think, the second time around, because they actually created the entire crown using the same technique for the entire thing. So all the flowers and fruit and leaves were all created essentially using the same three techniques.
Oh.
And so you know, working for a year doing the same three techniques probably would have been less stimulating for both of us. So we were very lucky to work on this one. I will say there were some techniques that I never want to see again as long as I live. They were so frustrating to accomplish. There's a bunch of grapes that I will probably have nightmares about for the rest of my days. So that was just no fun to create whatsoever.
And you can't just modify. It's got to be as exact as possible. Yeah.
We had to make it as close as we possibly could, and I think that we really achieved that. Time will tell, I suppose, when people come to study this. But it was quite a time in my life, I've got to say. And what I got out of that was a great deal of perspective, but also a new approach to my own designs, and being able to include techniques that are not commonly done, which is something I love to do.
And this Benton and Johnson, do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah, but gold. Just about any gold work material—that's where it comes from. Is that right?
Gold work threads are produced either in the UK, which is Benton and Johnson, or France, or Spain.
Okay.
For the most part, I'm not aware of them being produced anywhere else. And most of the ones we have access to in North America are the ones from Benton and Johnson.
So for them, even to be producing stuff that hadn't been done for a long time had to been a real challenge. I mean, wrapping gold that fine around needles. Oh, man.
No. That was actually us. They provided.
Oh, that was you. Oh.
Yeah, they did what they could, but you know, they're, you know, a commercial business with, you know, a lot of orders that they have to fill. So
so there's no money in wrapping gold around needles. Go away.
No, that's right. Yeah, they certainly wouldn't make their investors happy, I'm sure. No, they provided Cynthia and I with the materials to actually be able to do that. And you know, it was... I have to give all credit to Cynthia. You know, we referred to the time I worked with her as my apprenticeship now. And because she was the one who conceived how we would do everything. She's the one with the ultimate knowledge about all this thing. And if I'm working on a leaf or something, because I still like some of the designs that we took from the crown, and I will say to her, you know, oh, I'm working on leaf number 54. Do you remember that one? And she'll kind of possibly remember all this stuff that we learned.
Yeah. So it refer to it as your apprenticeship. I was going to say that project alone must have elevated your stitching skills considerably.
Yes, actually, I think it did. I mean, it would be for other people to judge that, but I've always enjoyed learning new techniques and new things, and that was sort of it was almost like an unplanned university education. That's the best way I would describe it. It was very intense, and of course, it was over winter, and you know, our winters are rather tough here in Ottawa. There would be days that I would be, you know, stuck in a blizzard kind of thing, and I'd be just working away at more crown elements, you know,
yeah.
Trying to make the best of the light as long as I had it, you know. And I'll tell you, you haven't lived until you've stitched silver fine plate along with white silk side by side, because the silver fine plate, if you can, it has the same texture as the tinsel that we put on Christmas trees.
Oh.
And so and you know how frustrating that is. And then you add white silk into the mix, and no matter what your light conditions are, they actually kind of look the same. So it's next to impossible to see. And so it was challenging beyond challenging is a really good way to say it.
So these men in the guild were absolutely out of control when they made that thing. Jeez.
Oh, I think they were having, I have said, and this is totally my theory, but I have said to Cynthia that, you know, I think they were having a contest with one another.
Yeah.
Who could do the craziest, wildest, never to be repeated technique again, you know? And, you know, I think they must have had their fun with it. It's the only thing that can explain some of what they came up with.
Wow, what an experience.
Yeah, yeah. I was really lucky.
Take it when you can get it. Tell me about, now, see, one of the things that that I've dealt with, and now I'm old enough I don't really care anymore, is a male in needlework, which, you know.
Yeah.
What? And you started this when you were a child, and I didn't start till I was in college. Have you kept that up, and how have you dealt with that male in a woman's world thing, or have you just ignored it and gone on?
Well, you know, you're right. So I learned from my mother, who was, she only did crewel work actually. And, she used to go to, Sears, believe it or not, way back when Sears used to have, a needlework area, you know, that where they sold supplies and kits and patterns and everything you needed to do needlework. And my mother used to buy the crewel kits there. And so I grew up watching her do these things in her spare time. And I was utterly fascinated by it. And I had to beg her for a long time to teach me how to do it, because she was a bit reluctant to. I don't think my father was thrilled with the idea. but you know, I persisted, and she eventually did taught me. So I learned, you know, I didn't know anything about counted cross stitch until I was well in becoming an adult. In fact, I don't think I took on my first piece until I was in my 30s. But I learned long and short stitch and French knots and colonial knots and chain stitch and all the things that most needle workers, they've gone the other route, and they tend to avoid, you know, wanting to work with a sharp needle on anything, you know. And so so that was never a fear for me. You know, I was doing French knots by the time I was 13, you know, and that was sort of where I started. And I have to admit, you know, I probably, you know, didn't go around advertising that this is what I did at home. But my poor mom, she used to get really angry with me because, you know, she was stitching these little crewel kits that were of mushrooms and, you know, leaves and flowers. And I really wasn't interested in those at all. I wanted to make up my own designs. So I used to steal all the towels and not towels, but pillowcases and sheets in our house that were white, and cut them up and draw my own designs.
Oh, geez, really?
I really did. I seriously did this. And she used to get really upset with me.
No, I can't imagine that. I just can't.
she would say, you know, I can't get over you. She said, I can't keep a white sheet in the house. And so eventually she got wise, and she actually started buying these big 70s floral prints to hang around the house, you know, so that I couldn't do that, you know. And but yeah, no, I did that for years. And you know, I used to stitch things like I would take a record album cover and I would transfer it and embroider the whole thing and stuff like that. I really did what I wanted to. And I didn't work with wool all that much. I went right to embroidery floss. So, you know, I could do finer work sometimes than my mom could. But I kind of got away from stitching for a very long time. I guess by the time I was about 25, I kind of put it away and didn't do it for a number of years. And then a family wedding was what got me back into it again. I was I offered to do a tablecloth as a wedding gift a family member and I said, you know, you can have all the guests sign the tablecloth and I'll embroider their names on it. And it's a great idea for a gift, but there's nothing more boring than embroidering signatures over and over and over. But when I did it, I realized how much I had missed it in those intervening years. And that's when I really got going as far as taking classes. You know, I went to my first seminar, which was actually an EGA seminar. I didn't know about the Embroiderers Association in Canada. So I went down to Naples, Florida. And my very first seminar class, I've never been afraid. I've never been afraid of taking on a challenge, as you can tell by working on this crown.
Yeah.
And so my first class, believe it or not, was Japanese gold work of all things.
Oh, way to ease in.
Oh, yeah, exactly. With the really wonderful Kay Stannis. And you know, it was probably, you know, a little bit more than I could chew at the time. But, you know, I learned and I learned rapidly. And so that was the kind of thing that I would do. You know, I would travel around to different parts of North America, attending seminars and taking classes with people like Jane Nicholas and Allison Cole and Hazel Blomkamp. And I would just acquire everything that I could from them. I guess I'm a bit like a sponge. You know, I just pick up what people are saying and what they're doing and how they approach things too. So but going back to being a man you know, in the needlework world, you know, I guess my whole life has been like that, because I had a career for 30 years as a nurse. So I was frequently the only man in a group of 20 or 25 women. And so I learned how to maybe negotiate that slightly uncomfortable feeling you might have. And so I guess I carry that over into the needlework world, where I'm, you know, the only man among a lot of women quite frequently. It's like a balancing act, I suppose, or a tightrope act that I've been walking for a long time. And it's become, you know, second nature to me now.
Well, yeah, being a nurse, that gives you a definite leg up in dealing with that whole thing. That's, yeah, that's,
Also with regards to teaching too, because I spent a lot of my, especially the latter half of my career, I had to do a lot of patient education, and the skills that I gained in both listening to patients and learning where they're at, and how to tailor what I had to explain to them to their specific needs, I found that when I retired and started teaching professionally, that I could transfer all those skills to, an embroidery workshop, because I'm alert to what the signals that people are giving off that they're not necessarily saying to you. Yeah. And so I can generally, pick up on those things and help them, because of it.
Yeah. Listening, a powerful skill. Not practiced very often, but powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, so the design part, you've never really just started designing. That was from scratch. Some people will go along and learn to stitch and then start varying off the prescribed pattern, and then pretty soon say, "Hey, I could do something on my own." You just out of the gate, you were just creating your own.
Yes, I did. I mean, having said that, I love to do lots of other, needlework and, other designers. I still do that. I mean, sometimes I don't want to design. Sometimes I want to run away from it for a while. And because it can get frustrating at times. So sometimes I just want to do somebody else's, work and just sort of escape the oppression. I mean, there is sometimes design can be an oppressive thing, when you're journeying through a project and you're not quite sure where you're going or where it's leading you. I'll pick up my Hazel Blomkamp kit and I'll work on that, just because it's nice to be led every now and then.
Yeah, isn't that true? Yeah.
Oh, yes. And then I come back refreshed to approach the design again. I often feel that a piece of needlework is kind of like a journey through a forest, because you have these areas where the path is clear and everything's lovely and you can kind of appreciate where you're at. But then there's these other areas where you're stumbling around the path trying to find it, and there are pitfalls that you have to avoid, and you've got to be alert to that. And then you come out on the other side of it, having been transformed by your journey through the forest. And I really feel that needlework is just like that, and doubly so when you're designing a piece.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now you have a lot of techniques at your disposal that you're comfortable with. And do I see in your work a mixing techniques?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
I'm intrigued by that, because I think we're seeing that with some frequency in designs anymore. We're not staying pure to black work or gold work, but mixing in these different techniques.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think that's the one of the joys, I guess, of the modern age, is that we're taking things from different cultures and we're blending them in. It's not unusual now to see someone create a needlework design and put shisha mirrors in them, and yet it's not technically an Indian design. But that's something that we consider to be Indian or East Asian, it's just a wonderful thing to be able to blend things together. Now there are purists out there, and so sometimes I have to if I decide I'm going to do something Jacobean, I'll try and stick to the kind of Jacobean profile, if you will, and not stray too far from it. But I've always enjoyed putting in as much technique into a piece as I can, just so, especially if I'm deciding that something's going to be a class, I like to give people who attend my classes the kind of arsenal that I have been given over time. So I'll throw in a stitch or two that wouldn't normally be put in just so that they can get the experience of doing it. And then they can choose whether they actually want to actually, you know, keep it in the finished piece or not.
Yeah. That's just looking at your designs. That's what I was picking up on is adding in variety, a lot of variety. That's what appealed to me about your work is it's not just, yeah, we aren't just going to do black work today. We're going to, or gold work or crewel or whatever. We're going to mix some things together and make it work. And that's got to, design wise, that's got to be the challenge too.
I don't know. I don't look at it as a challenge. I think it's just how I personally want to operate as I'm doing. I get a great deal of pleasure out of doing that kind of thing. Whereas if I was stitching just the same thing over and over and over again, I find that harder to complete. If I'm just working the same technique incessantly, and or the same style of technique for, you know, a bunch of different things. I've spent much of this year doing white work designs with sort of the, and when I say white work, I'm talking, you know, like the French monogram style of white work, you know, non-counted with lots of raised satin stitch and other techniques. And I've spent a good part of this year doing that. And so I've come out on the other side of this with a desperate need for color. and I'm sort of trapped at the moment because I have a niece who's getting married next summer, and I have taken on the task of designing a bride's handkerchief for her. And so I'm working away at that, and I've had quite enough of white work for this year, and here I am doing more of it, you know. So sometimes I kind of nail myself actually into these prisons, and I have to find a way to work my way out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's and white work itself. I mean, you took a class, or I don't know how many classes, from Hazel Blomkamp. I follow her stuff, and just amazing to me. But that white work and the texture that she gets out of just white thread never ceases to amaze me.
Hazel is really interesting because she really renewed, and this is totally my own opinion, but she brought something new to crewel work in particular that had, I don't think anyone else had ever done, or had certainly not been able to promote the way she has. And that's bringing other tech, like you said before, bringing other techniques that had not been part of crewel work. So bringing in needle lace to crewel work, and bringing in needle weaving, and then adding beading, and then three-dimensional beading on top of that. But she's continually evolving our concept of what crewel work is, and I just applaud that. Her designs are really complex, and they're, in my opinion, a lot of fun to stitch. And that's what I try to do in my designs as well. I try to make them interesting and fun if I can. And people so far have told me that they have been. So I hope I'm on the right path there.
Well, it seems like you are. Yeah. Yeah. You've taken classes here. I mean, the list of classes, when you mentioned Allison Cole and Jane Nicholas and Kay Stannis, and I don't know Jet Roy Finley Heath, but
it's actually Yetta. Yeah.
Oh, Yetta.
Yetta Roy Finley Heath. Yeah, she is one of the main teachers of Hedebow needlework, the Danish white work, and I think I've taken more than one class. It starts to roll together for me because not only have I taken classes with these people, but they've also become my friends as well. And so, you know, I have a lot of engagement with them outside of class. And I, you know, sometimes I can't remember, did I actually study that with you, or did we just talk about it? she lives in England, but she's Danish by birth, and she teaches only Hedebow. And I know she's taught at the EGA many times, and she's taught here in Canada many times as well. So, she's a wonderful, wonderful teacher.
Yeah. All right. Got to check her out. See what you're doing is giving me guest ideas here. So appreciate that.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So what is your, what are you working on now to stretch your skills and get incorporate something new? Are you stump work? Where are you at in your own growth?
Oh, well, this year, I've spent, this year, my design path has been, in Russia, I guess, which is rather odd to say, but I had this, series of Russian folk art kind of floating around in my brain for the last few years. And sometimes design ideas, they just won't go away. They keep coming back and keep coming back until I'm actually ready to do something with them. And so this has been my Russian year, it seems. So I've completed a really, I think it's quite a lovely white work bird based on Russian folk design. And I'm also mostly complete another evening purse using Russian lacquer work design. And there's a name for it, which I know what it is, but I can't pronounce it. And if I do try to pronounce it, it's probably going to sound obscene. but it's that folk lack, you know, the flowers and the berries and everything that show up on the black lacquer work in Russia. And so those were the things that really inspired me this year. And I'm just coming to the end of that. And then, for 2020, I've got kind of a free year in 2020. So I have ideas about what I want to do. I've had some stump work in my mind for a long time, and I've been resisting it a little bit, because I've been working on a stump work casket for myself for a number of years, and I am just about done the first panel on it. And, I would like to get more of that done before I charge into creating a design to teach in stump work. And my journey, if I look at it now when you ask me, it's more like, you know, three steps forward, two steps back, I think. So I don't follow a clear path, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm intrigued by the Russian part because I follow a number on Instagram, a number of Russian needle workers, not necessarily designers. And the approach and the designs fascinate me. There's a different flavor to them. I can't really put my finger on it. And I really have enjoyed just watching this handful of people that I follow and the work that they do. And so it's interesting that you have latched onto that. At least to me it is, because what do I know about art, but it's certainly in needlework, we don't seem to get much exposure to it.
No, it's true. And a lot of my designs are actually inspired by art or art history. And I don't know, I'll latch on to something and usually it's because it won't go away. Like a good example of that would be the little needle set that I created from the Magna Carta. When the Magna Carta traveled across North America in 2015, I kept seeing photographs of the documents, and there was this incredibly gorgeous E that had been, you know, painted by some probably monk in 1300, and that E just wouldn't leave me. And then I kind of got the idea that I could do that E in the monogram techniques of white work. And so I charged into it, and before I knew it, it sort of turned into, you know, a needle set. So, yeah, I do get inspired a lot by art, and it's not all old, or not, you know, say Elizabethan necessarily. I'm inspired by a lot of things: Art Deco, Art Nouveau, different folk arts, you know, Hungarian. You know, I've been through a Russian phase this year, and next year it might be Chinese. Who knows? I latch onto things, and then it kind of germinates after that.
I love the phases. They just kind of happen to you, huh?
I'm like Picasso, you know. He had his cubist phase and his blue phase, and you know. So I've just been through my Russian phase. There you go.
Yeah. Talk about the there's two designs that fascinate me of yours. One is the purse, and you mentioned you're doing a second one, and then the other one is this Mirador Andalus design.
Oh, yes. That's probably my favorite of all my designs. Actually, I'm glad you asked me about that. So there's an interesting story to that design. So that came out of a trip to Spain. That was how I celebrated my retirement. Was I went to Spain the month after I hung up my nursing shoes, if you will.
Is that that's what nurses hang up is their shoes?
Yeah, yeah, pretty
much. I wasn't sure what it is they hung up. So okay.
And then our feet go up on a stool and they never come down again.
Yeah, you know? No kidding.
Because we've been on them for so many years. But no, I to celebrate my retirement, we went to Spain, and southern Spain in particular, and I was so transfixed by the Moorish art of southern Spain. It's just everywhere, and it's like a massive imprint that says we were here all throughout that territory. And I was very much inspired by the tile work in the various cities, Seville and Granada and Cordoba. And so I got this idea to design some buttons, embroidered fabric covered buttons, using elements from those Moorish tiles. And it sort of started out because of my guild. We were running something called a button club, where we were having somebody design a new button every month, and then people who wanted to stitch it could make five buttons. And so a whole bunch of us, you know, started designing these buttons. And I had come up with so many designs that I decided it would make a nice class. So I created it originally as a one-day class for a seminar, thinking it would be a fun thing for people to make, you know, these five buttons that they could then put on whatever they wanted. And then the seminar selection committee came back to me, and they said to me, you know, we really want to run this, but we want it to be a two-day class. Do you think you can do that? And I was just stumped. I thought, you know, you have something in your mind and this is the way it should go. And I thought, well, how do I stretch these five simple little buttons into something more substantial? And by chance, I had decided to mount them on a piece of linden wood, which I had sanded and polished and you know, varathaned as a nice way of displaying them. And I looked at that and I realized that should be part of what it became, but then to do something else with it, I eventually hit on the idea of the embroidered mat that goes around it. So the mat on that is silk, actually, and so you have, and the buttons themselves are actually done on it's the heavy duty muslin for quilt backing. It's almost what I call industrial strength muslin. It's stiff and it's hard and it's not as fine as most muslin is. And when I was looking for fabric, I found that muslin to be the closest thing I could find to stone. And I still haven't found a fabric that conveys the image of stone better than that one. So so you have these buttons that are on this fabric that look like stone, and then you've got the wood, you know, the look of old wood, and then you've got fine silk around that, and the contrast of the three is really quite breathtaking. When it doesn't photograph well, unfortunately, but when you see it in person, it's really quite something. And the actual design came about through three of my the people closest to me in my life all had a hand in deciding how that little silk mat was going to appear. Literally, by I did a lot of my designs on computer, and we were cutting out different designs and sticking them and rearranging them on paper, you know, to try and come up with something that worked. And so when the whole thing was done, I realized just how much meaning this had to me because of my nursing career, and then the trip to Spain, and then the people that I love helping me with the design. So that is one design that I think if ever I had to go to a desert island and take one embroidery, that would be the one I'd be taking.
Yeah. Tell me about that, because I love the buttons, I love the design, but it's that mat, that embroidered silk mat. How is that constructed? What are we doing there?
Actually, so with this particular class, I just taught it a few months ago in Victoria, BC, and the problem with this class is that the setting up the frame to be able to stitch that mat on takes an entire day, just to be able to set up the frame and stitch the design on. And then the actual embroidery on that is just one stitch over and over and over again. It's whipped stem stitch, which gives the look of fine calligraphy when you do it with a single thread. And so when we were going through the class, it was interesting because people would be coming through, other people who were attending seminar would come through, and they would be looking at what we were doing. And, you know, it was getting towards, you know, 2 o'clock on day two of the class, and they still hadn't actually started to do one stitch on it, because they were, it's very complicated to lay out the design, because you have to actually transfer the design onto the fabric after it has been laced into the frame, because accuracy of the, you know, how square it is and how even the sides are really important in that, because it's part of the framing in essence. So, so laying that out took an awfully long time, and there was a great deal of laughter in the class about how I spent the, you know, 2 days essentially making them, lace frames and set up designs, you know. So, but everybody really did enjoy it, and laying out a design on frames in that way is something that a lot of people don't know how to do. So I think from what they told me, they really enjoyed learning new ways of being able to design their own needlework.
Yeah. Fascinating. Wow. Yeah. Right. Tell me about purses.
Oh, purses. Yes. Okay. Well, the purse you're talking about is the one that uses the climped elements. So they're geometric elements that come from various climped paintings. And that particular purse came about because, and it has an interesting name, it's called Cheryl. And it's because it was inspired by my last boss, actually. She was, or she is, a really wonderful woman. And we got on extremely well together, and I had a great deal of respect for her. And I wanted to do something as a thank you to her, as a tribute to her, for those last 4 years of my career. And so I had decided that I wanted to design a purse to teach at a seminar. And then her color scheme, the clothes that she wore, the clothes that she looked best in, kind of got mixed into that. And so the pinks and the creams and the golds, they were the colors that looked really, really beautiful on her. And so somehow it all merged together into this design. And then the climped part of it, I had always loved the artwork of Gustav Klimt, and we had an exhibition here at the National Gallery of Canada a number of years ago. And what struck me about it was when you look at those paintings, you see that those geometrics in one way, but if you see them rendered in black and white, they look entirely different. And that was when the possibilities of those geometrics occurred to me, that they would work well in an embroidery. And so that's how that all came together in that one design. And then I named it Cheryl to honor my boss, because she was what really inspired it all in the first place.
Well, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's there's beads on it, unfortunately, and I hope that anyone who uses it isn't going to get their clothing torn by it or anything like that. So I haven't heard any reports of that so far.
Okay. Beads. Unfortunately, you have to stitch beads.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Mike, I've really enjoyed this. I got 100 more questions. You got to come back.
Oh,
yeah.
I can't believe it's over, actually.
Yeah,
it
no.
Went faster than I thought it would.
Yeah, that happens. Yeah, there's 100 more questions. You got to do another show. Yep.
Yeah. Oh,
I would be most honored to. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you. And thank you for making it easy.
Okay, let's send them out. Before we started recording, you told me what the name PAR means.
Oh, yes. Thank you for remembering that.
So destroy my self-esteem one more time.
One more time. Okay, so I was telling Gary that when I was studying genealogy books, I came across something that talked about the meaning of people's last names, the traditional meanings. And our last name, the meaning is dweller of the cattle enclosure.
Yeah.
Oh, Gary.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Okay.
All right. You know what? For every name like that, there's always another one that's even worse out there. So,
yeah, that's going to be in the bottom third, though, I think. Yeah.
Maybe maybe we should start looking up the meaning of Pfeiffer.
I already know what it is. It is
yeah,
the maker.
It means pepper.
Yes, and also that there was a word from Germany, and or my husband's family's from Germany, and it was makers of like flutes. Of the five.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Like the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
Right. And my maiden name is Epperson, which is English. And I believe they're cobblers, is what I believe that means. The son of a cobbler or something, I think.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm.
See, you're all classy on us here, Vonna. We're just cattle enclosure people. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, now, Vonna, you have to design yourself a shoe.
That's right.
That'll be my challenge. That'll be my challenge to you. Embroider a shoe for yourself.
All right. I got to get through spiral trellis stitch first.
Okay.
All right, Mike. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to everybody for listening.